Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Heroes, I gotta say, you're all so sweet. Seriously, the response to the show so far has been amazing. All your tweets and your sweet comments, and especially sharing the show with other people who might enjoy it, is so, so appreciated. So, thank you. My guest this episode is game designer Hannah Schaefer. You've probably heard of her first game, Questlandia, and the recently kickstarted 14 Days. She's also working on a dystopian science fiction game right now called Sentencing Day. We talked about all three of them and so much more, in between a lot of giggling. So, enjoy! Hannah Schaefer, it's great to have you on the show!
Hi, Alex! Thanks for having me!
I'm so glad that you could make it. It's super exciting to be talking to you. I was literally playing 14 Days this morning, like a few hours ago.
That's so exciting!
Well, I really enjoyed it. And well, if you can give our listeners just a sort of basic pitch of what 14 Days is all about.
Sure, yeah. So 14 Days is a sort of combo board game, role-playing game about life with chronic migraines. And in the game, you play two characters who have chronic migraines somewhere in the world. You don't know each other, and you're sort of independently playing out 2 weeks in your life as you're dealing with the realities of, you know, unpredictable pain.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I played it with someone who suffers from chronic migraines, and I think he was really nervous to play it and was worried that it would kind of like hit too close to home or be like, too much. But then he ended up really, really enjoying it.
Oh, good.
And I feel like I learned a lot. And it's also, you know, it's a game that like I think is designed to build empathy and like teach. But it's also just really fun. And it's not just the story of people with chronic migraines. It's the story of just like everyday people like trying to live their lives. Were you sort of consciously thinking about that as well when you were designing it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, migraines are, I feel like to really have an impact, you sort of have to go specific to general. Like you have to pick something specific to be able to really communicate something powerful and individual. But, you know, people play the game and they're like, this totally relates to, you know, my other type of chronic pain or to depression or PTSD. So, you know, I think that just in terms of the experience of being a person living an unpredictable life, which is every person and every life ever, I think it's a game that's really adaptable to a lot of different circumstances.
Absolutely. So it's kind of an interesting fusion of board game stuff, right? There's a lot of resource management and that kind of thing, but also it's very much rooted in story and in character. Mm-hmm. I wonder, what did you have kind of an audience in mind when you were making this game?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it was really important to me in working on the game that the final product could be something that could be played by an audience that maybe had never played a role-playing game before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like role-playing games are quite a niche thing. And so are board games, but a little bit less so. So I wanted to make sure at least to be able to hit the audience who would be comfortable picking up a board game first and then sort of throwing this story game element into it. Mm-hmm. Hopefully not in a deceptive way. Like, surprise, now you're playing a role-playing game.
We'll trick you into the hobby. Yeah, not the approach.
You know, in a friendly way that sort of uses this board, like there's a board and there's a box and there's tokens and those are very familiar pieces. So hopefully it's kind of easing people into the story game element.
Mm-hmm. That is really interesting to me. I mean, it's certainly written in a very accessible way. You don't say this is a role-playing game. You're like, this is a game where you'll tell a story. You kind of take on the role of a person. And I find that interesting because you've described yourself as a relative newcomer to the hobby.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, which is interesting. So what makes you say that? What's your kind of history of role-playing games or your history of games?
Gosh, so let's see. How long have I? Well, I guess we're in 2016 now, mm-hmm. a few days into 2016. I've been role-playing for less than 5 years now, I'd say. Definitely less than 5 years. And came to the hobby sort of by chance. I'd always been interested in role-playing games and then ended up meeting a bunch of local game designers here in Western Massachusetts at just sort of a random chance community event and kind of confessed to them that I'd always wanted to play a role-playing game, but didn't really know how to get started. And so this beautiful friendship was formed. And then and then from there, I started making games. I always wanted to be a game designer, a writer slash game designer, but I thought that it would take the form of video games. So this was sort of a surprising turn. But it's great. It gets me off of the computer sometimes.
Briefly.
Briefly, yeah.
That's interesting. Do you have a background in video games? Like, have you produced stuff in that? Or were you kind of like, screw that once you found role-playing games?
At the time that I met all of these local game designers who are like Emily Kerr Boss and Meg Baker and Vincent Baker and Joshua Newman, we have some amazing indie game designers here in Western Massachusetts. It's this little like hidden treasure trove of game designers. At the time, I had been working on a video game that was about the end of the world. And it was actually making me pretty depressed working on this game that was sort of this collapse scenario and thinking a lot about, you know, my own life as somebody who had recently graduated from college and was a little bit directionless. And you know, video games are great and I love them, but spending way too much time on the computer trying to work on this game. And it just like something just clicked. I met these amazing folks and had some of my first tabletop experiences where, you know, you're sitting down face-to-face gaming with somebody, which is something that I hadn't really done a lot of since I was a kid, at least. And it was just really profound discovering, you know, what it could feel like to play a tabletop game. And it just felt like the right thing.
That's wonderful. I love that. And I love that idea of like being able to connect to other people in such like a direct and like, you know, in-person way. And I think it's so sweet that you still consider yourself a newcomer, because I think 5 years is like, you're good. Like,
oh, well, thank you for giving me some cred. Yeah, I don't know at what point you officially can like take on the title of like resident old-time gamer.
Yeah.
Maybe 5 years is the point where, you know, you get the medal.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of weird status stuff kind of wrapped up in like, I've been gaming since such and such and this edition. And
sure.
Yeah. Bleh, gross. Who cares? I think your sort of like self-professed newcomer perspective is actually really valuable. Like in Questlandia, which I love, the text explains everything up front. I mean, you even say like, this is what role-playing is, which a lot of role-playing games don't care to mention. are you sort of designing or writing for other newbies?
I hope so. Yeah. You know, it's something that I worry about. I worry that the more I'm designing for, or like the longer that I'm designing for, the less I'll be designing for the me that would have really appreciated a role-playing game made for newbies, if that makes sense. I'm worried that I'm going to sort of lose track of that like really accessible spirit that meant a lot to me when I was first getting started. So hopefully I won't lose track of it. But yeah, I mean, I love tabletop games. I love role-playing games. I wish that everybody played story games. And anything that I can do to widen the audience and make it easier for somebody to jump into a game for their first time and understand the text without feeling like they have to do an apprenticeship in that game to understand how to play it. The work will feel worth it if I can, you know, get a few more people playing role-playing games who hadn't considered them before.
That's an awesome goal. Also in Questlandia, you have, which I don't think I've seen anywhere else, a completely concurrent, like left page, right page, actual play, like a record of play that sort of goes along with the flow of the rules. And as it tells you how to do things, it shows an example of someone doing that. Where did that idea come from?
I mean, actual plays, I feel like I'm seeing more sort of actual plays in role-playing games. You see them sometimes at the end of text, like now that you know the rules, let's see an example of what it's like for real people to play this game. The idea of putting them side by side made sense at the time. I'm still really glad that we did it. But I totally understand why nobody else does it because it's a layout nightmare to try to match. You know, here's what Joshua is doing at this part in the game to here's what the corresponding rules are at this part of the game. People seem to really like it unless they're reading the game on an iPad, and then it's really upsetting and difficult for them. But generally people have really liked it, but it was very difficult to lay it out in InDesign. So I think that actual plays are a great idea, but I totally understand if people don't want to lay them out side by side with the corresponding part in the rules.
So one of those, like, glad I did it, we'll never do it again type thing?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, maybe by the time I'm making my next, like, big role-playing game, I'll forget the drama of it and just jump right in and start laying it out. But definitely going to need a few years before I do that again.
Well, that sounds all right. I mean, that's another great thing about 14 Days, actually, is that it's quite compact. You know, like, it doesn't take a long time to read. It doesn't take a long time to understand. And you can kind of play as you go and sort of figure it out. And if things come up, then it's very easy to look up things in the rules because it's like 15 pages or whatever.
Oh, great. Well, I'm glad you think that. Thank you. That's good feedback to
right,
get.
I'm trying to think if there was a question in there, if I'm just gushing. Well, I have a couple more questions about Questlandia. Maybe just tell our listeners real quick what Questlandia is all about.
Oh, sure. So Questlandia is a game that I co-designed with my partner, Evan Roland, who I tend to make all my games with, but he's sort of quiet and can kind of get forgotten about. So Evan is great. I make all my games with him. He's wonderful. So Questlandia is a game about building a non-traditional fantasy kingdom from the ground up and then watching it crumble under the weight of its own social and political dramas, basically. Everybody takes on the role of a character in the kingdom, and then you get to work to achieve this big personal goal while your world basically collapses around you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun, despite the dark subject matter.
It is, though, and it's a very, very collaborative game because, from what I understand, I've not actually played it, but I've read the heck out of it. It's one of my shelf games. You take on the role of a character, but you also take on an aspect of the world, or maybe multiple aspects of the world that you kind of own as well.
Yeah. One thing that I had experienced in some GM-less games was that GM-less games will say, do this and come up with all of these world building elements and play fair and make sure everybody gets an equal chance to talk. Or sometimes they don't even say that. Sometimes it's just like, at this part of the game, build the world, be great. And I found that as somebody who is a really shy role player and doesn't want to step on other people's toes, and in a lot of collaborative games, I was actually just kind of getting walked all over and wasn't really contributing anything at all because I was so worried about stepping on other people's toes or worried that I was doing something right or wrong. So in Questlandia, after a new element is introduced to the world, like let's have psychic mushroom fairies, somebody will take on ownership of the psychic mushroom fairies. And then anytime that they come up again in the game or there's a question about them, the person who has ownership of them is the one who gets to answer that question. So, you know, the most excited player can't always answer every question about the world. That responsibility has to be distributed among all the players.
That's awesome. And I was going to ask you about that exact thing. I was wondering, was that your intention from the get-go of like, I want to make a collaborative game that actually allows everyone to collaborate? Or did you create something one way and then through playtesting discover, ooh, I got to put some limits on this?
Yeah, I think it was both. I mean, I wanted to have a collaborative game that gave everybody space to speak in a way that hopefully they're comfortable with. And, you know, that was the hope from the beginning. And then through playtesting, I was able to sort of tweak where that was working and where that wasn't working. And, you know, it's not perfect. I'm sure that there are still people and places that might push it those rules, but you can't design a game for everyone.
Yeah, so true. And yours is obviously, I think Questlandia seems to me like it's designed for people who are looking to do something collaboratively and looking to like get everyone's input. And so the rules support that intention. But I don't know, that intention kind of has to be there. I mean, have you play tested it with people who were not totally in the spirit of it? And, you know, does it rub some people the wrong way?
Oh yeah. I mean, some of the early playtests are where the ownership rules come from is, you know, people who were sometimes excited in a really good way, but just kind of contributing. And you can sort of watch really, really creative but quiet players in a game like that just sort of drift away. Like they're on an iceberg and you just watch them floating away. And now they're not really in the game anymore because there's somebody who's just so enthusiastic to the point that they've pushed this person out. So you kind of had to adapt based on that. And then, you know, watching some people who ignored the ownership even after it was there. And that's okay. I can't force it on them. I mean, you know, you can give people the rules that you wrote and then hope that they'll respect them. And beyond that, that's sort of all I can do. And, you know, it's not a game for everyone. Generally, it's played and playtested really well, which I've really appreciated. Everybody that I've ever had in a game of Questlandia post-playtesting has really enjoyed it. Some of the playtests were a little rough, but that's par for the course.
They should be, right? Like if someone wants you to play test a completely finished product, it's like, what's the point of this? The other kind of delicious morsel from Questlandia is the power of veto. And that's baked right into the rules. How soon kind of in the design process did that come up as something like that you really wanted to have?
That was a really early thing. And I think one of the most important things. And I think that the main inspiration for that one was watching some games of Microscope and being really inspired by some of the stuff that Ben Robbins used in Microscope to basically say, like, at any point, if you don't want to play in a game with sentient amoebas, like if that's not your jam and you're not going to have fun in that game, just say no. And nobody can argue. Like you can sort of negotiate around the yeses. Like, yes, this is something I might want to see, but looking a little bit different. But if there's something you really don't want to see in a game, the conversation just ends there. And that was really important from the beginning.
And that's wonderful. And I feel like we often try to implement some kind of equivalent rule in a sort of meta way when, yeah, apparently you can just put it right in the book and then it's there. So Questlandia and 14 Days were both sort of co-designed, you and Evan Rowland. I have to ask, what's it like co-designing and co-designing with a partner specifically? Is it stressful or is it great?
It's both stressful and great. It's like the best and worst thing ever simultaneously. I mean, I can speak for co-designing with other people also. I think that co-designing with a partner is probably very different from co-designing with a friend or another designer that you're working with professionally, because you take all of your bullshit into the design process and it's hard to let it go. But I think it also, you know, leaves the opportunity to make something that's really honest and true. So for me, it's been great, but we've had to set up a lot of rules around sort of like when is design time and when is like normal couple hangout time. And there's a lot of bleed between like, when are we hanging out and making dinner and not talking about games? And suddenly we're talking about games again. it creeps in there. So you have to be careful.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's a lot of boundaries being like that you'd have to newly form that you never thought you'd have to make.
Yeah, for sure.
That's really interesting. Would you say that as much as it's more frustrating, but there's also something special about designing with someone that you're really close with and that you can get to something that maybe you couldn't with other people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's like, you know, when you're making something creative, I think that your best friend or your partner is going to be the first person who has your back and really understands how much that thing means to you. So then to go to the next level and be making that thing with this person, it's so special.
Aww, that's wonderful.
It's really cool. It's like having a creative baby, but not a real baby. You channel your love and energy and enthusiasm into your role-playing game together.
Cheaper than a dog.
That is true.
That's interesting. And I like the way that you describe that, because I think we kind of have a myth of like the indie designer who does everything completely themselves.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you have some thoughts on that.
Oh, it's a great, I mean, when you, I guess it's not something that I've really thought of even at a conscious level, but it's totally something I see that, I mean, I think is, it's amazing when I see people who have done a Kickstarter totally by themselves, where they're sort of new, they don't have like a lot of community support, and they've done the layout and the editing and the playtesting and everything solo. And it's amazing, and I applaud them. But I think that working with a partner has shown me the value of making, of just how much I get from making something with another person. And I think has opened me up to the idea of working with other people, and just shown me what other people can give me in terms of their editing support and their advice. And it really makes, for me, I think it makes a better game. I don't think that these games that I've made would be very good, was it not for the people that I've been working with.
I know you're also involved locally with a kind of co-working space or a cooperative space, Owl and Raven. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, it's funny because, and this is a totally okay question, but it actually, so let's see, I'm trying to think of where to start. So Owl and Raven is this community game design co-working space that's been in operation for about 5 years now. And at the 5-year mark, this is when we finally decided to shut the space down. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, which is totally okay. When, you know, when we tell people, when I've been telling people, everyone's like, oh no, I'm so sorry. But it's one of those projects where like, it was amazing, it was great, and now is just the time. It's like, it's run its course. So Owl and Raven has been this incredible game design co-working space and game space. It's where I met all of these wonderful game designers. It is the place that I can attribute to my, like, why I'm a game designer today. But it's really, really challenging to run a nonprofit and totally draining, and has sort of sucked a lot of the life out of its volunteer members over the years. So we've gotten, I think, about everything that we can get out of it, which is literally like relationships and best friendships and jobs, like everything you could want out of a game design space and more. So we're finally shutting it down so we don't have to pay the rent on the space anymore. But it's been a really amazing thing for the past 5 years and has totally changed my life.
That's amazing. What are some of the lessons that you're bringing from that experience?
Oh, gosh.
Or is that going to take a while to?
Yeah. Well, the lessons are that it's really, really hard to run a co-working space. Mm-hmm. You have to both be a creative person and a business person and a person who deals with the flooding when it happens every year. You have to do like all the parts that are great and all the parts that aren't great at the same time. And I mean, it's made me a better business person. I don't even know where to start. There's so many lessons. I'm so glad that it's something I did. And I'm also like so over it at this point. I'm like, goodbye.
Yeah, that's good. Clean break.
Yeah.
Well, I know from your involvement in Owl and Raven, and also just from some of the stuff I've read on your blog, you have an interest in communities and how communities operate and how they can be more resilient. I was wondering, especially because you still consider yourself a newcomer, are there things that you admire or things you appreciate about the role-playing community?
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. Well, let me think about some of the things. There's so many things. I mean, one thing that I've appreciated about the role-playing community is, gosh, everyone's so friendly. Everyone that I have encountered is so friendly, especially in this sort of story games corner of the role-playing game community. People have just been really, really so giving with their time and their experience and their creative energy and patient when I haven't understood rules or how to play a game. So I've really appreciated that most everybody I've met is like so excited to have another person playing role-playing games. And I mean, like a big thing right now in gaming communities at large is gatekeeping and sort of who we invite into a gaming space and who we push out of a gaming space. And it's just something that I almost have not experienced in, you know, this little corner of the indie gaming community. I think it does exist and I've seen it in little places, but focusing on the positive, it's just been a really, really welcoming community. And I think one of my favorite things is how amazingly giving people have been with the things that they're creating. Like I've come into this community and people have said like, here's a game that I'm working on. I'd love for you to hack it. And it really goes against what I feel like I was told my whole life, which is like, if you make this thing, you have to hide it and protect it and not let anybody steal it. And in, like, I've just experienced the total opposite in this little section of the indie gaming community.
Oh.
So a little long-winded, but
no, that's great. And I mean, my follow-up question has to be, are there things that you're seeing in the role-playing community that you would really like to change or to see changed?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess, you know, to follow up on what I said before, I'm seeing these hints of gatekeeping that are really shitty, and I don't think that they are welcome here. I think that sometimes generally they're not intentional, at least when I've seen them in the role-playing game community. I think there are places in like the video game community at large. I don't even know if community is the right word
for that.
In video games at large, where it's totally intentional. I think where I've seen it in RPGs, it's not intentional. I think it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction to feeling like something is changing in a way that you're not ready for. But that's gatekeeping. So, you know, I think it's really important for people to welcome new designers and be patient with new designers who, and not assume that everybody's been doing this forever and that everybody knows the terminology and knows the questions that have been asked again and again over the years, because making those assumptions is going to shut people out who are really, really valuable members of this community. That's what I would want to change.
Nice. That's a strong statement. And there are ways to do that, right? Like I said, like, you know, your games don't have a lot of upfront jargon. You know, it doesn't say this is a one shot, you know, that can be a campaign and all this other stuff. It just explains what it actually is.
Yeah, hopefully. It's this, you're constantly writing this line too between wanting to use the jargon for the people who can really grab onto it and also drop in some explanation for the people who don't know what an apocalypse world hack is. And they're going to be like, what the hell is that? I don't know what that is.
Yeah, you know, when you just say those words together, it just sounds like complete madness. That's cool. That's really interesting. So I recently listened to the first episode of Games People Play, which is the podcast that you did with your sister.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful.
It's great. It's a really interesting idea.
Yeah. Games People Play is a podcast that I'm doing with my younger sister, Alana Schaefer, who is not as much. I mean, she plays games, but wouldn't necessarily identify as a gamer. I think we both identify as players of games and not gamers, for what it's worth. So we've wanted to do a creative project together for a while because I love my sister and I don't get enough time to hang out with her and do fun things with her. And we knew that we wanted to do a podcast, and I was interested in doing sort of like a heavily games related podcast, and she was interested in doing something more that kind of railed on popular culture and deconstructed like social minutiae. So we took this idea of Games People Play, which is inspired by this 1960s psychology book called Games People Play that breaks down social games into these like little social transactions and talks about things like the stalking game, you know, when a woman walks into a room and tries to get all the sexual attention on her by saying that she ripped her stocking. It's a very outdated book. And at some point we'll be delving. It's like this super outdated mannish psychoanalysis book, but I love it. It's amazing, and it's sort of a relic. So we are in our podcast coming up with our own social games and deconstructing them from this sort of gamer lens, like breaking them down into, you know, who plays this social game as an indie gamer, who plays this social game as a casual gamer or a hardcore gamer. It's a little bit hard to exactly pin down what we're doing in the podcast, but but it's been really fun. And we're about to film record our second episode, which I'm really excited for.
Good, good. I listened to the pilot, but I'm glad it's moving forward.
Thank you.
I love that in the first sort of the introduction, you introduce yourself as a designer and appreciator of games. What does that imply? Unpack that a little bit for me.
Wow, I don't even know. Sometimes I'm surprised at the words that I end up using to describe my relationship with games. And honestly, one of the things that I'm working on is becoming more confident in my assertions about my, you know, my sort of role in this community. People have been I don't want to say correcting me, but pointing out that a lot of times when I say I'm a designer, I say it like with a little uptick at the end, like I'm a designer. And they're like, it's not a fucking question. You're a designer. And so, yeah, that one's like going to be a little hard to unpack. An appreciator of games, I guess an appreciator of games in that I love playing games, and I also appreciate games on sort of a theory level. I love thinking about the relationship of games to, I don't know, our culture, and I've been thinking a lot about Gamergate right now and some of these things that I'm still really trying to unpack. And I've been sort of overwhelmed with how quickly games came into popular culture and then how much backlash there's been as, you know, people have been like, I'm a gamer too and an appreciator of games. I don't even know what that means. I'm going to think more about that one.
That's what I do here on the podcast. I just like find the weirdest thing you've said and then make you explain it.
Like, what does that even mean? Like a connoisseur. I like roll games around in my mouth a little bit and then I swirl them and then spit them out and think about them for a while.
But I think there is like, there's more than one way to play a game, right? There's the just, I'm just going to have this experience and sort of enjoy it and then move on. And then there's the like, I'm going to think about it and write about it and talk to other people about it. And it seems like you place a lot of value on the latter.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think about something like, this is something I was thinking about a lot. I don't remember when the Game Chef competition happens, but Game Chef is this games competition with a focus on sort of experimental story games, although you can really make any type of game. With Game Chef, you take, there are these four ingredients that are given to you. And if you maybe correct me if I'm not describing this well. There are four ingredients, and I think you have to use three of the four ingredients. And the ingredients might be something like bridge, hope, prisoner, and
cricket.
Cricket. Yeah. So you pick which of the ingredients you want to work with, and then there's an overall theme that you have to explore, and the theme might be something like, what is a book? And you sort of interpret that theme to mean what you think it means. But at the end, you know, the entries are judged based on the text, because usually with the competition, you don't have time to actually play the game you've made. And people who are judging don't even have time to play the game you've made. So I think when I think about like what it means to be an appreciator of games, like that's a really interesting thing, because it's a game competition where most people haven't even played the games and maybe never will. And so it's like, what are we really judging here? Are we judging the game? Are we judging the text? So maybe when I think about being an appreciator of games, I think about something like Game Chef, which, you know, takes this idea of game and removes it pretty far from my idea of a game, but they're still games.
They're just not played.
They're not played. So then is it really a game? I don't know. I don't find the question of what is a game that interesting. Like, or I don't find the answer that interesting. I find the question interesting.
Well, and that was actually going to be one of my questions, because in games we play, you know, it's all about identifying the games that people don't realize that they're playing, or that people don't identify as games. And I was wondering offhand, although I'm not going to grill you and make you come up with one, if you have a sort of working definition of what a game is, or if you have two or three that you pull out on different occasions.
Oh, gosh. I'm just going to straight up say that I don't. At some point, I think that I'd like to look back to the original games people play text and see. I have to remind myself how he defines game in that text, because I remember the definition being really interesting. And I wish I could pull it up right now, but I don't have it in front of me. Yeah, I don't know. I've had this conversation with people before, and I just feel like I haven't settled on a definition that's personally satisfying, because there are so many games that, like, there's some games that I've really enjoyed recently that are video games where you're sort of clicking through and, like, you're this semi-active participant in a story where you just have a few choices you make along the way. Like, there's some Telltale games that are like this, and this game Life is Strange that I just finished and loved has you make these story choices, but you're never shooting anything. There's like a few kind of time-based challenges, but mostly you're just kind of like playing this choose your own adventure story. And is that a game? To me, it feels like a game.
and that is honestly a big question, just because, like, the interactive fiction folks, who I love to the max, are often kind of rejecting the label of game, because they sort of want it to be thought of as fiction. But then there are lots of other people who are doing almost identical work, but specifically taking hold of the term game to be like, no, this is a game. You know, you don't have to kill stuff for it to be a game. It can just be a way of interacting with something. And
yeah,
so yeah, you're right. The question is a lot more interesting than the answer.
Yeah, I guess I should have my own working definition, but I'm so worried that once I have that, it's just going to change really quickly. And, I'm going to have left something out that is a totally valuable thing that should be considered a game. So for now, I'm going to try to avoid coming up with a definition, but it is something that I think about.
I like the idea of deliberately not having a definition.
Yeah.
I think that's bold. I make games. What are games? Who knows?
Who knows?
But that leaves things open, right? Oh, speaking of podcasts, the super exciting thing, I mean, by the time this episode comes out, there will already have been like two or three episodes of it, but yeah, you're joining my former co-hosts on TTS, on Tabletop Superhighway.
I am, yeah. And I'm super excited, except really bummed that we had to, like, not be able to be there at the same time.
So. I know, we had no overlap. What attracted you to the project?
I think that what they're doing with Tabletop Superhighway is really neat. I like the things that have already been talked about, like taking role-playing games, but kind of focusing on these little elements of game design or game theory, and like highlighting individual role-playing games or designers by focusing on these broader topics that are, I think, applicable, like widely applicable to game design in general. Like, I think you did one on like sex in gaming.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. So you can take those topics and highlight these, you know, designers or specific games by talking about these more broadly applicable things. So I think that's really cool. And beyond that, just in conversations with Larry and Jesse, who are the other co-hosts, they asked if it was something I was interested in. And I was like, heck yeah.
Well, that's rad. I definitely encourage all of our listeners. I'm sure you all listen to TTS already, but in case you don't, you should totally go over and listen to Hannah and Larry and Jesse. Another big, exciting project coming up soon is Sentencing Day. Please tell us a little bit about Sentencing Day.
Yeah, Sentencing Day is another game collaboration, although this time not with Evan Roland. This is a collaboration between me and a good friend of mine, Brian Van Slyke, and it is a tabletop game, Apocalypse World inspired, to use some jargon, a PBTA hack. So Sentencing Day is based on this short story that Brian wrote by the same name. And the short story is about these two friends who are about to graduate from high school. They're about to turn 18 in this world where you have to serve a mandatory prison sentence when you turn 18. And the minimum sentence is 1 year. But naturally, people who have grown up with a certain type of class status will be serving lower sentences, and people who grew up without, you know, everything handed to them on a silver spoon are serving longer sentences. And the original story is about these two friends who, as they approach their respective sentencing days, are like just coming to terms with their privilege for the first time. Or, you know, one of the friends is coming to terms with his privilege, and sort of realizing that there's this gap between him and his best friend that he never recognized before. So I thought the story was amazing and it really moved me. And I asked Brian if he would be up for adapting it into a role-playing game, and he loved the idea. So we're making this game about, you know, a bunch of teenagers at sort of this formative period in their lives, realizing that their world is fucking them, as, you know, as they're just about to go off and maybe serve the minimum sentence, maybe serve the maximum, to sort of put in time for crimes that they haven't actually committed.
It's such an interesting hook. I love that, the idea of like mandatory prison sentencing. It's so different from contemporary America, where that's only true if you're poor. What about that made you think that it would make a good game? Because it's kind of an adaptation in a way, right?
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, in the book that, or in the short story that Brian wrote, it was just focusing on these two friends, one who, you know, was sort of given everything. He's the A student. He's serving the minimum sentence. He's like held up on a pedestal all the time, whether he likes it or not. And, you know, his friend who grew up poor and is, you know, if he even so much as glances at a teacher the wrong way, he gets another mark on his permanent record, which equals more time in jail. And it seemed like an amazing opportunity to explore some of the kind of gray areas between their like there's this huge gap between the like the A student and D student privilege. And I was like, ooh, what about the B and C students who aren't really represented in this story? You know, maybe come from, you know, a family who came into some wealth, but are, you know, Black. And so they're afforded some privileges and not others. Or, you know, what's it like to be a C student woman in this world, who's somebody who's sort of trying but consistently underperforming? So those just seemed like really, really cool stories that were sort of in between that big chasm. And that's what we're working on with this game.
Interesting. So what has the design process been like for you and your partner in crime this time around?
Well, let's see. We started the game as a Questlandia hack and brought it to Metatopia a few months ago, and had one amazing playtest where people were like, oh, this is great. We love it. You know, it needs some work, but this is amazing. And one playtest where it just totally bombed. Oh my God, it bombed so hard. and even that was really, really helpful. So we sort of took the game back to the drawing board. And, you know, I think it's amazing that we have all of these game tools right now, so we don't have to totally reinvent the wheel. Like, Apocalypse World is out there as this thing that you can like tweak to fit your game if that works with what you're doing. So I think some of it was also that I've been playing in a Monster Hearts campaign, which uses Apocalypse World as its base. And it's a very different world from Sentencing Day. In some ways, Sentencing Day is a crueler world, but the characters are kinder than they are in Monster Hearts. You know, in Monster Hearts, a lot of the things you can do are related to like manipulation and sort of wringing somebody to get what you want. That's not the case in Sentencing Day, but I was really enjoying what it felt like to play Monster Hearts. So we've now reskinned it, you know, based on feedback to sort of fit this Apocalypse World hack game, and haven't even playtested the new version yet. So who knows? I don't even know what it'll look like in a few months.
But that's exciting though, right? And you just sort of let the game be what it needs to be.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, it's all a result of listening to feedback and trying to find common threads in what people say and then, you know, adapt it from there.
Yeah. Well, you've written some interesting things about playtesting specifically, and I've heard you speak on TDS actually about playtesting. We don't have a ton of time, but are there recommendations or sort of things that you'd like to say about for someone who is going to hopefully playtest someone else's game that you think folks need to know?
I think the biggest thing that I would say that maybe is a little contrary to what I've heard other people say is that I don't believe in stress testing, at least with strangers. I think that stress testing makes sense in certain cases, but I think that when you're just designing your game, you know, often I've seen people bring a game in where they're like, okay, here's, you know, the game that I'm really excited to try. And somebody will say, all right, what do you think, like, the magic system. Is the magic system working? Let's find a way to break the magic system. Or, you know, okay, you haven't seen it in operation that much. Like, let's really push the magic system to the max. And I think that as long as you are a savvy designer, it's really important to just watch people play the game that you've made, and probably the broken parts will be revealed along the way. And if you have like something that's really crunchy and mechanical that you want to test later, that's just fine. But it seems like in early playtests, the hyper focus on stress testing starts to really bring things in the wrong direction. That's my opinion. It might be wrong. I don't know.
I'm kind of with you. I'm kind of about playing games the way they were meant to be played. You know?
Yeah, there's a lot that can be revealed that way. It's just like, see if the basic game works first, and then work on the little nitty gritty stuff later.
And also, like, speak to your experience as you're playing it, right? Not to what it could be or what it might be, but just what. Did you enjoy it? Did you have fun? Did this work for you?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people start to play devil's advocate when they're playtesting or like speak in these sort of hypotheticals where they're like, well, if I was this, then maybe this. And like, don't do that. Like, did you understand it? Did you have fun? Like, let yourself have fun in a playtest and let yourself understand it. And don't be playing as just like this like hyper-focused playtester who's trying to look for the cracks. Like, play the game as a player. Maybe that's my main bit of advice. Play as a player, not as a play tester.
That's great. That's a lot more pithy too. That's good. That'll be the pull quote. Well, Hannah, it's been super great chatting with you. For our listeners who want to keep up with what you're up to and maybe learn more about Sentencing Day and your other future projects, is there somewhere where they can find you?
Sure. Yeah. My website is makebigthings.com. And that's not just my work. That also is Evan Roland and Brian Van Slyke, who's the other collaborator on this project. We'll be all putting more and more of our work on that site. And then if people want to find me on Twitter, my Twitter handle is HanBandit.
Awesome. Well, yeah, unless there's anything else that you really want to like, oh, got to tell the people this.
Got to complain about playtesting for another 20 minutes. No, I think that's it. I think I'm all good. Thank you, Alex.
Well, a big thanks to Hannah for coming on the show. We'll have a link to her website and social media in the show notes. Next episode, I'm going to be talking to another brilliant tabletop game designer, Laura Simpson. And when that show drops, I will be at Dreamation 2016 in Morristown, New Jersey. Dreamation is an incredible convention put on by Double Exposure for games of all kinds. LARP, tabletop, board games, card games, minis, everything. If you're anywhere near New Jersey, I strongly encourage you to check it out. And if you do, find me and say hi. Just follow the sweet, gentle sound of my voice. If you have thoughts on today's episode and you want to reach out, you can always email me at backstorypodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Google+, Backstory Podcast, or you can tweet at me at @backstorycast. And remember that Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can go to oneshotpodcast.com to find more great shows like One Shot, Campaign, Modifier, and Talking Tabletop. That lovely music you're hearing now is called Thinkin' of You by Ujiko. You can find more of their work at soundcloud.com/Ujiko. Talk to you later, heroes.